Campus FM presents a talk in the Work in Progress seminar series entitled When the Dark Night Rises, the Morality of Public Space. This talk is delivered by Elise Billiard.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening, radio audience. It gives me great pleasure to welcome Dr. Elise Billiard to speak tonight on the intriguing title, When the Dark Night Rises, the Morality of Public Space in Pacheville. I'm sure that has attracted a few of the people who constitute what must be the largest crowd we've had this semester at the seminar series. Dr. Elise Billiard holds a PhD in anthropology from the University of Provence. She has done fieldwork in Cameroon, in its biggest city, Douala, researching the domestication of modernity in homes of the wealthy. After looking at domestic and private lives in Cameroon and in Malta, she turned her interest to public spaces, initially basing her research around the Citygate project in Valletta, which led to a joint publication by Elise Billiard and David Pisani called Transit, which was published in 2010. And those of you who had the good fortune of going to her seminar at Europa House several years ago will remember the interesting comments she had to make about the necessity of informal public spaces in any city, if it is to be a city. And this led her to an interesting critique of Valletta rehabilitation. This month, with David Pisani, Elise will be publishing a photographic duograph entitled Night and Day. I think we can see from her biography that, in fact, Elise has devoted considerable attention and energy to thinking about and researching space, public space and private space, not only in Malta, but also in Africa. So, Elise, welcome.
Today, I would like to share with you my ongoing research on Pacheville's recent evolution, which I think is relevant not just for Pacheville, but for the future of urbanism in Malta. Although Pacheville is still today a unique case. For the past 18 months, I have conducted independent research on the streets of Pacheville, interviewing residents and bar owners, tourists and students in English learning schools, and also just sitting in cafes and observing the flow of life, as anthropologists do. My fieldwork is not concluded yet, that's important to stress, and this presentation will be a work in progress, to which I hope you will contribute by sharing your comments and your ideas. So please feel free during the discussion to tell me what you think. In Malta, it is a habit to conclude a discussion by stating the all-encompassing exonerative expression, "Yes, but Malta is small." Indeed, the island can feel claustrophobic at times. When I need to take a break from the insularity of the island, I head to Smart City, or Tinier Point, or Porto Mazo. Entering these spaces, I feel I am traveling for free. I enter a place which does not resemble Malta at all, a free and open space that does not seem to belong to anyone, a known space, as Marc Auger would argue. However, it is also a place that feels strangely familiar, with an insistent sense of déjà vu. In these places, there is always a fountain or a marina. There is always a nice view on the sea. And the view of the infinite horizon projects me anywhere. I could be anywhere. I dream I'm in a future city, far from the mundanity of my daily preoccupations, far from my inquisitive, although friendly, neighbors. I sit down by the fountain and I look around. There are no cars, and the sea breeze of ocean air caresses me, And there are even some trees where birds can find refuge from hunters. The terraces of the cafes and restaurants are impeccably maintained, with potted plants blossoming high on nitrates. Immaculately paved sidewalks framed by manicured lawns, miraculously thriving under the scorching sun. George Fenech, the head of Thomas Group and the initiator of such developments in Malta, aptly understood the formula, and he declared, this was in the Times of Malta, "I believe that you do not buy property, but a lifestyle. Few people want to live in an apartment per se today. They want security, facilities, and an address to be proud of. To be sure, the piazza of these developments are well thought out and have been overseriously designed. The architects have read Richard Rogers, but maybe less Jane Jacobs. And they have included the mixed-use mantra of the new compact city. There is shopping, obviously. There is relaxing, the fountain, the restaurant. There is working in the obligatory business tower. And of course, there are high-end residences. One could spend his entire week in this kind of development without using his car once. That's the point. The public space is not only well thought of socially, or at least at first glance, but it is equally aesthetic. Even if the palm trees and the arcades are not one's cup of tea, one must recognize that compared to the cheaply built modern blocks of flats in Pacheville or Sliema, Porto Mazo definitely stands out as a quality development. Tine Point, my favorite, has an equally high standard development, is even more refined. With its complex structure of buildings, with its asymmetrical terraces and patios, it reproduces, at least from afar, the Mediterranean skyline with its rooftops and the narrow inner streets remind me of the ancient Moroccan city of Fez, where rays of sunlight cut through the dark, shady street walls. I am told that the apartment's interiors are also very well taken care of, generally with the help of a qualified interior designer. On the website of Panda Gardens and Tignes, the prospective buyers are offered the services of an interior designer attached to the consortium, but they also have the possibility to bring their own designer. And indeed, these developments are the kingdom of designers who do not only arrange the private spaces to resemble international hotels, but they also design the private streets and the squares, with the result that any trace of individuality is eradicated. To me, it seems as if the public square of these developments was a private space. It is so carefully manicured with its view, its clean benches, its pristine paving and green plants in pots. It is so well arranged, the height of the pavement so finely calculated, the colors of the walls so well coordinated, that one feels as if he had stepped inside an interior magazine's photograph. However, but the point I shall be making is that such developments are heterotopias, enclaves, or capsules that negate the outside world. I will argue that far from fostering a sense of community, as the word gated community suggests, and the central piazza may aspire to embrace, these are non-spaces where the public space is suffocated under obsessive control. And finally, I will suggest that they damage the public space left outside by encroaching on free space, thus drastically limiting mobility. These observations were inspired by my work in Pacheville, an urban area that I feel is a micro-laboratory for the future of urbanism in Malta. So what about the morality of public space? I have entitled this presentation, The Morality of Public Space, Not Only When the Dark Knight Rises, to emphasize an aspect often dismissed or at least misunderstood. I see two reasons why public spaces are moral. Firstly, urban public spaces are where one is confronted with strangers, people who are not like you, and learns to cohabit with them. Not always very peacefully, but still. The second reason is that norms of behaviors determine the ownership of urban public space. And this we will see in the case of the nightlife in Pacheville. Let me start by explaining that public spaces are moral because public spaces are where confrontation with strangers occurs, and thus where a shared system of values is acquired, consciously or not. That's where you interact. For instance, this is where a child learns that he can or cannot expect help from stranger when stumbling over a stone. Just an example. Here it is important to stress that the socialization that comes from street-level interactions is distinctly different from the socialization that occurs in comfort zone of privacy at home or in the village, okay, within a group of friends or family. In an urban area like Pacheville, where most people are strangers to each other, there are the residents, but there are also a lot of strangers. Here one interacts mainly with strangers. In such contexts, actions are judged as actions. There is no understanding of the action in the perspective of the individual's life or status or reputation. Such a recontextualization can only exist between people who know each other, such as in the village or in the family, but not between strangers in Pacheville. In the urban public space, there is no pre-existing attachment. Actions and reactions are only meaningful per se. So here you see I'm speaking about urban public spaces, not village public spaces. They're different. This leads to two important correlates. First, that it is in the public realm that society is constructed. It's not only in the private space. I am referring here to urban society, the Gesellschaft, the society of strangers, the city, as opposed to the village community, the Gemeinschaft. But although a city is full of strangers, an urban society is not just the sum of distinct individuals whose lives have little in common. An urban society is one entity that is much more than the sum of its parts. We are thinking of Durkheim here. It is a society where individuals, although strangers, cohabit, negotiate territories, cooperate at times, exchange information about a football match or about the job market. Or at other times, they can despise one another, opposed on their social status, in what they perceive from the other. Most of the time, citizens are blasé, and care little about the neighbor's tattoo or the nose piercings. That's why people say they are more free in cities. However, they will eagerly engage in conversation if the buses are running late or if the sun is shining after a long wintry spell. These everyday and seemingly mundane interactions are what builds a society. To put it bluntly, there is no society without public interactions. The second correlate, which is no less essential, is that urban public spaces offer to the individual the possibility to refine his judgment and his moral values. Using the word of Anna Arendt, one could say that public spaces are where an individual becomes human. for Hannah Arendt, being human meant to be able to think for oneself, to discern good from evil, which she thought was an increasingly rare capability in the modern world. For her, it was only in the public sphere, when actively engaging with the other around us, in debating about the norms of public life, that we enact and nurture our humanity. There is an anecdote of the French poet Baudelaire, who in the 19th century was seated on the terrace of a new and trendy cafe in Paris, in the Haussmannian Paris, and was confronted by the sight of a poor family in rags, staring with admiration and envy at the luxurious facade of the café he was in. Baudelaire describes it. He speaks about the whiteness of the walls, the expanse of mirrors, the gold corniches and mouldings. He felt guilty of his comfortable lifestyle. He later wrote, "Not only was I touched by this family of eyes, but I was even a little ashamed of our glasses and decanters too big for our thirsts." This is the kind of situation an urban public space enables. The confrontation with the other triggers instantly a sense of obligation towards the dispossessed, the outcast, the populace. However, as Baudelaire also shown, it can also trigger the impulsive desire to reject poverty and to forbid the street to those who do not fit the ideal of a pre-designed social picture. The unsuitable, would say Mike Davis. Baudelaire recalls the reaction of his lover, who was seated at the cafe with him, who said, "Those people are insufferable with their great saucer eyes. Can't you tell the proprietor to send them away?" In a world where social inequality is increasing, the need to choose between generosity and refuge becomes unavoidable. Okay? This is the morality of public space. There is a second reason I foresee. The second reason, I believe, reinforces the concept of morality in public spaces, of public spaces, is that norms of behaviors determine the ownership of a space. Morality here is understood as a system of values that define and determine norms of behavior. This is a bench in Porto Maso, in the marina. An example of such behavioral norms are the signs that ban ball games or dogs or roller skating or cycling, like here, which prevents many children, dog owners, people wanting to cycle, to actually come here and use the space. Another example of restrictions of ownership of space are the public benches that are bum-proof. The expression is of Mike Davis. This is a photo taken in Los Angeles by Mike Davis. It's published in his book, The City of Quartz, 92. And here you see that it's a bench where one cannot sleep or have a nap. There are others here. This is in Paris. Another way to prevent people to lie on the bench. Popular among city councils such as Paris and Los Angeles, many others, the benches are designed to prevent anyone lying down on them, thus excluding homeless and tramps, or even just a tired commuter from taking a nap, or therefore temporarily owning that space. But as William Hollywhite stressed, lively public spaces are places where one can sit. In Pacheville, benches are almost inexistent, If not in the marinas, as we've seen, but also in the semi-private garden, the only garden of Pacheville, in which CCTV cameras keep an eye on anyone wanting to use the beds, the benches as beds. I will come back to this garden later. Thus, I would argue that regulating the activities and behavior of citizens implies regulating the access to public space, thus reducing its openness. So is it a public space? Regulations can be imposed by an authority or by the owner of the semi-public spaces, such as libraries or cafes. But regulation is also imposed by practice. In the case of Pacheville, it's obvious that the nightlife, with its populace of inebriated and joyful people, prevents other people from using the streets or the beach at night. Okay, so here there is a negotiation of territory. This leads me once again to concur with Anna Arendt that the public space is a place for intense and constant negotiation. It is the conflict over the norms of behavior as much as the conflict over the ownership that defines a public space. A space which is entirely under the submission of one set of rules, such as in the enclaves, determined and applied by one preselected owner, or developer for that matter, where a systematic and well-delimited morality is imposed, is not a public space, it is a private space. Thus, public space is crucial for democracy, because it is the object of intense negotiations. It is the object which is common to all. It is what lies in between citizens that do not know each other, but they share this one thing, this public space. The materiality of the world, the facades, the urban furniture, the layout of the streets, but also the waste collection, the rubbish, the cleaning of the streets, big issue in Pacheville, the public facilities, another big issue, post offices, health centers, schools, are what connect and separate us at the same time. Indeed, as Arendt writes, to live together in the world means essentially that a world of things is between those who have it in common, as a table is located between those who sit around it. The world, like every in-between, relates and separates men at the same time. The public realm, as the common world, gathers us together and yet prevents our falling over each other, so to speak. So it separates us and connects us. Here Arendt warns us that once there is nothing to discuss, once there are no issues to be resolved between two parties, then there is nothing that relates strangers together. In Pacheville, public space has been dramatically reduced in the last 30 years. I shall now look at the different kinds of Pacheville and semi-private spaces in Pacheville. To identify the public spaces in Pacheville, I will first use this map, the Pacheville Policy Map. You can, it's online, you can access it easily. Made by MEPA and dating from July 2006. I will show that most of the public spaces which are listed in this map are in fact not public spaces. For instance, the Porto Mazo Marina is considered a public space. So public spaces is this, open public spaces it's called. There are all the dark green areas. This is the garden. This is the stretch of land where people used to park. between the West End. This is the West End, this is Porto Maso. This is Pender Garden. And here is also an open public space. This is the Cavalieri Hotel, which, as you know, is not accessible. And we're going to speak also about the coastline with public access. These are the categories used by MEPA. So, for instance, the Porto Maso Marina is considered public open space by MEPA, even though all its gates are closed at night, except one. And even though by day and by night, access is controlled by security officers whose behavior tolerance is very limited. As we saw, no balls, no bicycles, no dogs, no naps, no stepping on the lawn, etc., etc. Even more restricted is the access to the coastline in front of the Cavalieri Hotel, which has been closed to the public by the construction of a concrete wall blocking the access. This is illegal. The only public garden of Patcheville, the only public garden of Patcheville is also listed as a public open space, even though it is leased to the Tumas group, who closes it at night and impose its arbitrary restrictions of use. Again, no ball, no dogs and stuff. It's for you. This was once a children's playground. This was once a children's playground with the useful colorful swing slides and merry-go-round. The park now resembles more a parking lot fitted with uncomfortable benches lined up around an empty center that a few trees and a minute water feature try to hide. Another public open space defined by the MEPA plan is the abundant stretch of land between Dragonara Street and West End. So, this one. Which has been completely enclosed by a wire fence on one side and by a wall on the other side. Probably because it had become an illegal parking place. It is nowadays deserted. No cars, but no people neither. Completely useless and inaccessible. Finally, the last public open space listed in the 2000 policy map, located at the bottom end of St. Augustine Street just before St. George's Bay, has been taken over by one of the most powerful entrepreneurs of Patcheville, Hugo Ketkuti. This is now Hugo Terrace. And before there was that high swing stuff, who also belonged to Hugo Ketkuti. Briefly, none of these spaces are really accessible and cannot for this reason be called public spaces. The same can be said for the natural coast with public access, so the light green area, I mean the coastline basically, which in practice is not accessible or only with difficulty, especially for elder people. The entire coastline is inaccessible except for St. George Bay and the little protected area, which is the stretch of rocks sandwiched in between the two sprawling hotels, the West End Dragonara and the Hilton. This rocky coast has been, for more than 80 years, the favorite spot of residents of Patcheville and has recently become the perfect hideaway for lovers under the moonlight, because there is no light. And I won't say how some people call that beach. The coastline on both sides of Porto Maso Marina is impracticable. It is striking to see how the three largest hotels, the Corinthia St. George, the West End Dragonara, and the Hilton Porto Maso, have practically taken over the entire coastline. It also needs to be pointed out that the only sandy beach itself is partially privatized by the beach club managed by the Intercontinental Hotel. So again, is it a public space? What is left to the public are the streets, which incidentally are not listed as public open space by MEPA. A careful analysis of the street layout reveals a segmentation of the urban space, which concentrates the motor and pedestrian circulation in the central open grid. This map, which is my, obviously, my work, I would say. I don't know how to define it. My playing around, maybe. This map illustrates the different blocks that have been created through the closure of a number of passageways. For instance, the development around the Lavalette and St. George hotels forms an enclosure that cannot be crossed. So that's the St. George. This is the famous or infamous Santa Rita steps here. This is another closure. What I call the central grid is this part, which is the oldest part of Patcherville, the hamlet, where most residents live. I'm going to give you more examples. Nor can the area around the Intercontinental Hotel, which means that the only way to go from Bay Street to the post office is actually through these Santa Rita steps, which are themselves, the Santa Rita steps, are themselves narrowed by the encroachment of the nightlife industry and has been narrowed down. Another example amongst many others is the enclosure behind Pender Gardens and its adjacent streets. So, Tree Il Alit, which you could, 8 years ago, you could still cross like that. Tree Ross and Tree La Pape. So even here there was a street which is closed down for the residents, which forces pedestrians and drivers to take either the residential Spinola Street or the road of Tree Gort and Tree St. George, which, as you know, in which motor circulation has become problematically dense. A nightmare, would say others. One can also see that the block formed by Bay Street and Villa Rosa prevents any access to the protected land behind it, thus isolating Pembroke from Patcherville. So basically, all that space here. This is a protected area, but you can't cross like that. And you can't cross here, because this is the regional road. So you see, the space is segmented in big enclaves or big segments. This segmentation of such a tiny area has several consequences. First of all, the public space in general is drastically reduced, either because it is difficult to access, such as the Rocky Beach, or because it has been closed off, such as the coastline around the west in Dragonara, or simply because it has been privatized, such as the place which is now Hugo Terrace. The second consequence is that such enclosures have rendered some streets crowded, whilst other streets are lifeless, such as the residential zone behind Villa Rosa is actually very, very quiet. Whilst all these streets here, because they form a grid and they're easy to cross the space, are crowded. This increases the demographic pressure on the residential central area, which is generally dirty and noisy, to the detriment of the residents' lifestyle. The third consequence is the general reduction of social diversity. In Porto Maso, for instance, in the area in front of the cafe or the Hilton Hotel, and even more so in the desolate marina, retired residents or young people idling their time away are seen are not seen in this area. Instead, a few white-collar workers from the Porto Maso Tower and wealthy visitors, Maltese or foreigners, comes to enjoy a coffee before heading to the luxury boutiques. The hill behind Villa Rosa, where villas are clustered, is also very quiet, almost deserted compared to the dense and mixed crowds that pass through the central grid. To understand the rise of segmentation, Richard Sennett proposes an interesting dichotomy between borders and boundaries, which I would like to use here. According to Sennett, there are two types of spatial divisions. On the one hand, borders are porous divisions which delineate two different spaces of activity or societies, but which can be crossed. Boundaries, on the other hand, are divisions that are impermeable and thus that do not allow any mixing. Boundaries are limits. Sennett warns against the increase of boundaries, such as the gated community's high walls or the highways. The highways that cut the space in two. Boundaries create artificial social divisions and prevent any interaction between individuals from different areas. So they segregate the space even more. Borders, on the contrary, are for Sennett creative spaces where different individuals and different types of activities can blend, such as the example is of a marketplace seated in between two socially opposed residential areas. And the market can serve as a meeting public space where diverse social groups meet. In Pacheville, as I have shown, spatial divisions are hardening. The case of the gated community of Pender Gardens is a case in point, since only residents can enter the enclave. And there is no true traffic, whether motorized or pedestrian. However, this is not the only case. There are less visible ways to enclose spaces. One can, for instance, make parking expensive, which keeps away the drivers who do not dispose of 6 or more euros to stay an afternoon in the area. The same goes for prohibitive rates at restaurants or cafes, an effective way to select consumers. As we have just seen, the closure of streets at one end to create a cul-de-sac is certainly an effective way to create de facto enclaves, as this map shows. It is interesting to listen to the experience of residents who all point out the transformation of borders into boundaries. One respondent recalls flying his kite as a child on the coastline in front of the former Hilton Hotel. Another one remembers meeting her future husband at the casino's regulars' balls. Inside the Westin ground lies the sunken garden. You know the sunken garden? Inside the Westin grounds lies the sunken garden, which was once the highlight of children's walk. Eager to come and see the two camels and the lion that were kept there by the eccentric Marquis Cicluna, who owned the land but made this garden open to public. Nowadays, this park is completely deserted, and several entrances has been closed. You can enter only by one side, a bit hidden away. Residents of the era, known as the Gardens, remember the shortcut of Tree Hill Alley that used to get to Pacheville. So the gardens here, and people, if I did it, you could cross this way before. Now this stretch has been closed off. The street was closed around 8 years ago. On the Spinola side, the residents used to enjoy the coastline in front of the Cavalieri Hotel, occasionally indulging in the hotel's pool as well, which is now blocked by an illegal wall. Porto Mazo Marina, until recently, was also accessible from the back of the Cavalieri Hotel. Here, there is a road here. In fact, you can see it on the plan. A road which is today blocked with a high fence. These examples illustrate the change in the urban fabric of Pacheville, from the porous borders between hotels and residential to the recently hardened and impenetrable boundaries that transform Pacheville into a labyrinth of segmented areas. So, once again, the only area of Pacheville that allows for a mix of people is the so-called nightlife district, which has taken over the original residential area of Pacheville, the hamlet. Here, there are no borders. The streets are laid out in an open grid in which pedestrians and cars cohabit. During the day, residents, young foreign students, businessmen, pensioners, tourists, and workers blend in the streets. The area is characterized by an eclectic mix of cafes, grocery stores, souvenir shops, discotheques, gentlemen clubs, and cheap rental apartments. But there is also a post office, stationery shops, pharmacies, two supermarkets, several greengrocer trucks, a church, a very active chapel, the Millennium Chapel, and an access to the sea. All of them amenities that a residential area needs. So that's an important point. This is not just a nightlife district. However, there are also recurrent issues in this area. The waste collection, for one, is regularly criticized, and residents I met expressed a tired disillusion regarding the local council's effort to improve the situation. For instance, they have long asked for public conveniences to reduce the smell of urine that prevails in many places. The constant noise pollution is another important issue. It is true that discotheque owners have improved the soundproofing of their clubs, but during the night, the loud voices of the partygoers disturb those who wish to sleep. During the day, the obsession to change the facades and interiors of the shops and bars regularly, almost every year, implies a constant digging and drilling cacophony that unnerves residents and tourists. The dress code is also a cause of resentment for some individuals who consider that the streets of Pacheville are not the place to beach wear, to the same extent that going topless or nude on a beach in Mota is socially unacceptable. So why here? This is without mentioning, of course, the opposition to the excessive consumption of alcohol, drug use, and prostitution. Many residents feel invaded and denied the right to live the quiet life they enjoyed 50 years ago. They do not reject the international and cosmopolitan element of the diverse crowd so prevalent in Pacheville, and many of them have and continue to host foreign students in their homes. Their perception of invasion comes from the change of norms of behavior en vigueur today. Generally, the bad morality, the loose morals of the streets of Pacheville is considered by most residents, many residents, and by many Maltese as the ultimate issue. Noise, bad smells, bikinis transgress their morality of cleanliness and acceptable social behavior. The growth of the leisure industry, clubs, restaurants, bars, has fostered a liberation of the moors that is oppressing for some as much as it is liberating for others. This is the fundamental argument of my proposition that public spaces are moral. If the central grid, the original Pacheville residential area, is the only public space left in Pacheville, it comes as no surprise that this area is the object of many conflicts between the different stakeholders. The nightlife is undoubtedly gaining precedence over the right of the residents to enjoy a quiet lifestyle. The littered streets are not sufficiently cleaned in the morning, and the lack of public convenience has damaging consequences on the inhabitants' thresholds. The Maltese media are filled with negative reports over this area of Pacheville. However, I would suggest that instead of looking at it as simply the problem, the issue, I think we should look at this area as the only place where solutions can rise, because it's the only place where there is a public space, where there is still some negotiation possible. The central grid is, at least until now, still in the hands of several stakeholders, the owners of the discos and clubs, the grocers, who sometimes are residents, the apartment rentals, the numerous small restaurants, and the residents. They all have different interests and tend to entertain conflictual relations. However, this diversity of interests provides the foreground for public debate over the one thing that all of them desire, the improvement of the commons. Most stakeholders agree on one thing, that there should be a stronger police presence, or that at least the police officers implement the law and punish inequalities, illegalities. We've seen that yesterday and this morning, it's all over the place. While I do not wish to disregard this option, I think that a better understanding of the situation would bring a more suitable solution. We should, first of all, discuss the implication of the tourism industry, which has almost single-handedly changed the face of Pacheville over the last 50 years. Pacheville is unique in Malta because there, and to my knowledge nowhere else to that extent, the majority of the users are visitors who do not spend more than 3 weeks in the area, or sometimes just 2 days or one night. The high number of hotels and rental properties brings a massive influx of new visitors every day. The wealthy enclaves of Porto Mazo or Panda Gardens also play an important part, because they are for the most part not inhabited by long-term residents which could engage with Maltese society in the long run or in the everyday interactions. It seems clear from several interviews that many clients do not live in Malta and use their apartments as a holiday base. Here again, I need to interview more people. A quick look on the internet also reveals that many apartments are rented for short stays by their owners being Maltese or foreigners. This implies that most residents of the enclaves are visitors that come to inflate the faceless crowd. Finally, when the dark night rises, the crowd of partygoers congregate in the central grid of Pacheville. In one place. Day and night, Pacheville is therefore a place of transit, a known place in the words of Marc Auger. Here lies the uniqueness of Pacheville compared with the general homogeneity and stability of the other urban or rural communities of Malta, in which a strong sense of place is prevalent, as we can see with the festas. In this perspective, the problem is not so much the nightlife itself, but the impossibility for the permanent residents and the long-term workers, the users, you know, to negotiate their vision of good morality. Residents have complained to me that they cannot voice their disagreement of transgressive behaviors, as it is commonly done in Malta, when, for example, they face an unknown group of youngsters who anyway will leave the islands in a few days' time. Moreover, the visitors do not fear for their reputation in a space which is not their own and where they know nobody. Gossip and auto-censorship is of no use in a known space. So this is why it's unique to Malta, or at least to that extent. In this domain, the establishments of enclaves, which are linked to the imperative of movement, change and transit, has far-reaching consequences. The global phenomenon of gated residential enclave is prospering. In a world where people are traveling more often and further afield, where an elite is able to own several summer residences in different continents, and where, for many, work involves considerable business travels, conferences, and meetings, individuals tend to seek refuge in closed private spaces in which they can withdraw themselves from the world around them. The slogan promoting Panda Gardens is particularly revealing here. On the high boundary walls of the gated community is the slogan, I'm sure some of you know, "Everything surrounds you." As if to stress the difference between the quiet inside of the enclave and the activity on the outside. The need to seek refuge in a private space is therefore a consequence of the increasingly fast pace of our lives. This is what De Coutre envisages when he writes that the increasing implementation of gated communities is a direct consequence of the imperative of movement. This is a paradoxical tendency. De Coutre describes the world as an interconnected global space, not the global village, a network that connects capsules. Capsules do not only refer to gated community, but encompasses also cars, computer or mobile phone screens, a thing that isolate you from the outside, but at the same time connects you with the network. I think that the term capsule is useful in our quest to understand the essential quality of developments such as Smart City, Porto Maso, Tigny, Panda Garden, among others. Their essential quality being to provide a refuge for those who spend most of their times in non-places, airports, generic cities, international conferences. Indeed, Porto Maso apartments are in majority, this is according to George Fenech, owned by foreigners, mainly British, Germans, Swiss and Dutch, with a minority of Maltese. All these enclaves are targeting foreign upper-class clients. They are not only sold at sky-high prices, but also benefit from the privilege of being the special designated areas, the SDA, which means that non-residents in Malta can buy more than one property at a time, rent it and buy it in the name of a company, without the usual acquisition of immovable property permit. What the clients of such enclaves are seeking is an idyllic refuge with a comfortable lifestyle, to use once again the words of George Fenech. These new developments are inward-looking, seeking to create private, self-sufficient living and leisure spaces. Sitting by the central fountain, looking out at the horizon, taking a stroll along the yacht marina, one is buffered from the constant sound of construction works that is so prevalent everywhere else on the island. Traffic noise also kept are also kept away. But there being no true traffic, and by providing as a resident of Pender Garden declares, it is nicely encapsulated to shield the noise from Patchville. But such enclaves are not only capsules that barnacles us from our surroundings. They are also utopias, or more accurately, heterotopias. Michel Foucault defined heterotopias as utopias put in practice and built in opposition to the real world outside. The point is not only that enclaves turn their back to the world, but that they are built in opposition to this world. Indeed, as Marc-Anthony Falson pointed in one of his thought-provoking articles in the Times of Malta, many enclaves borrow from the rural imaginary and Mediterranean folklore to color sanitized spaces into seemingly villages. The best example in Malta, or I shall say in Gozo, is Hal Satria. This is the website, the official website. Here, the village gossip, you have to have a look at the video, at the film, the promotional film is fantastic. Here, the village gossip, aka the webpage, tells us that apartment owners can enjoy the fresh produce from the fields, which are part of the property. They will also be able to play bocce in the garden. This is true. Bake the traditional Godzitan way in a stone oven. Make their own bread, you know. Pray to St. George Preka, of course, in the village square. And do their laundry at the bespoke Ein Tal Hasselin, unless they prefer the maid and laundry service also available. If Hal Satria is an extreme case, it is nonetheless visible that enclaves are built to create a sense of community away from the city, anonymity, and blasé attitude that Simmel described a century ago. As one client writes on the Pender Garden website, you feel like you are part of a large family when you live at Pender Gardens. The veracity of this testimonial might be doubtful, but in any case, it reveals the marketing tactic of the Penderville Consortium. Aesthetic plays an important role to foster an imaginary of village life. After all, the slogan of Ray De Micoli, associate who designed Porto Mazo, is, "We believe that the quality of our surroundings can lift the quality of our lives." The Midi Group, owners of Tignes Point, is not far when it declares as its mantra, "Building a future with respect for the past." And indeed, the architectural style of such enclaves is often a modern reproduction of historical city centers. Remember Tignes with his Mediterranean skyline, or of an exotic destination, Porto Mazo and its palm trees. But a community cannot be fostered by good architecture alone. And some architects have forgotten this, it seems. Community is a social political entity that has at its center an efficient public space. It seems essential here to repeat an obvious fact that public spaces are made of people. An empty and yet aesthetically beautiful square is not a public space. And in contrast, the desert can become a meeting place when, for example, two caravans find each other and settle their camp for the night. It is as if the village aesthetic of such high-end developments was designed with intent to hide the resounding lack of exchange between residents. A former expat residence of Porto Mazo justified her decision to leave the development for a village in the south of Malta, because she recalls, in Porto Maso, it was like living in a hotel. According to her, there was no interaction with the neighbors. She pointed out the constant turnover of inhabitants and how lonely she felt at times. I would argue now that it is the overdeterminism or overdesign of such developments that itself negates the conditions for community. Sorry, it's a bit long, but... Gated communities are often called golden prisons. This is usually said to stress the irony of the privileged class that choose freely to live and raise their children in a completely enclosed space, surrounded by private police and barbed wire fences at a significant cost. Tignes is a case in point, with the German company Siemens having installed a state-of-the-art and unprecedented system of control. This security system, located in Manuel Island, registered the movement of each door. And like everywhere else, there are dozens of CCTV cameras in the corridors, parking and public spaces. Panda Gardens and Porto Maso also promote themselves as safe places. But safe from what? Is this need for security really crucial in a country like Malta, which does not have the crime rate of cities like Mexico or Mumbai or Johannesburg, where gated communities are exploding? My observation in Pacheville leads me more to say that far from being a necessary evil to protect oneself against urban criminality, enclaves like Panda Garden, St. George Complex, Porto Maso, or West in Dragonara are in fact fostering urban violence. By turning their back to Pacheville's central grid, they reduce the available footprint of public space, and by increasing the influx of temporary visitors, they have transformed a quiet coastal district into a place of transit. I also see another reason, and this is the most important for me, to compare enclaves with prisons or detention camps for that matter. Enclaves are golden prisons because there is no public space. In the enclaves, there is an almost absolute lack of ownership from the inhabitants, who relinquish their right to decide together the issues relating to their public space or their common space. The rules of behavior along Porto Maso Marina, for instance, are not the result of its frequentation, which actually is fairly limited, nor is it the result of a discussion between inhabitants of the enclave. No, it is a contractual clause that the developer takes charge of the management and maintenance of the common space, which is mostly referred to in the contract as the common areas. So, in total opposition to the central grid of Pacheville, in which there is constant conflict about what kind of behavior is tolerable, there are no territorial conflicts inside Porto Maso and Panda Gardens. There cannot be territorial conflict, because the space belongs to the developers and not to the people inhabiting it or using it. The dilemma around enclaves is not only that they are unfair, because only wealthy people can afford such a lifestyle. The dilemma I see is that enclaves suppress debates, prevent the fostering of a sense of place, and ultimately preclude the necessary conditions for democracy. Enclaves are therefore private spaces in which a strong depolitization occurs. They are conceived only as addresses to be proud of, but not address to defend. Inside the enclave, the long corridors and private piazzas can only be consumed passively, rather as a spectacle, as something beautiful, you know, but rather than actively created by the populace at large through political participation. With nothing left to be debated, not even the color of the exterior walls or the price of the pool membership. What can the users of such enclaves have to talk about? Now they are facing each other with nothing to connect and separate them, and have only one issue: quickly returning to their capsule home. The public space is this in-between strangers that enables them to remain distinct as much as the common object that keeps them related. Allow me here to quote at length again Hannah Arendt. What makes mass society so difficult to bear is not the number of people involved, or at least not primarily, but the fact that the world between them has lost its power to gather them together, to relate and to separate them. The weirdness of this situation resembles a spiritualistic séance, where a number of people gathered around a table might suddenly, through some magic trick, see the table vanish from their midst, so that two persons sitting opposite each other were no longer separated, but also would be entirely unrelated to each other by anything tangible. This is what happens when there is nothing left to debate, nothing to conquer, nothing to fight for. Once a public space has been entirely withdrawn and regulated by an almighty authority, then there is no public debate, no society, only the juxtaposition of discontinued lives that do not meet. So it's not a society. Public spaces are not only places to sit and discuss the latest football news. Public spaces are, more importantly maybe, places of territorial negotiation, places owned by a diversity of strangers with different and at times opposed interests. The imperative for democracy is therefore the possibility for the different stakeholders to discuss the commons. To conclude, I wish to insist here on what I think is an essential yet too often forgotten condition for lively public spaces. Whether or not a street or a square is well designed is not so important. The design of a place is important only to the extent that it precludes or leaves free a great diversity of activities such as sitting, walking across the city, shopping, playing, or idling, doing nothing. But what truly determines, in my opinion, the liveliness of a public place is the fact that it is a common ground that individuals share and negotiate. A public space should be the object of constant territorial conflict, the space for debate over its uses. This is why public spaces are moral spaces. In the last Batman film, When the Dark Knight Rises, is the title, Bane, a dark and masked anti-hero, this is Bane, a dark and masked anti-hero rising from the depths of hell, hijacked the stock exchange before locking up the whole police force of Gotham City in an underground tunnel. He sets free the convicts from the city's prison, and a new court of law replaces the establishment. Once the dark hero has abolished the financial, executive, and judicial powers, he proceeds to declare to the citizens, all gathered for a soccer match in a stadium or watching their match at home in front of their private screens, that he has come as a liberator, not as a conqueror, to return what is rightfully theirs, and enjoins them to take control of their city. Take control of your city. Of course, Bane is a direct reference to the movement of Occupy Wall Street, in which, in September 2011 in New York, masked activists were showing their anger against the almighty financial market. However, in Batman, the people's liberation is not the result of popular uprising. Indeed, the power is not taken by the citizen, but given to them by a dark hero who actually turns into a tyrant. The streets of Pacheville, the streets of Gotham City, sorry. The streets of Gotham City are quickly shattered by total anarchy. The palaces robbed of their gold, law and injustice become the theater of a farce, and the police are arbitrarily replaced by gangs of ex-convicts. There's also a lot of references into the French Revolution and the Commune, I think. The example of Gotham provides a good counterpoint to what enclaves are. They are not in total anarchy, where it is no longer the rich who retain power. But in many aspects, the situation in Gotham City is very much like the one in the enclaves all around the world. Because in Gotham, as in today's gated community, the public space have been erased. Hannah Arendt's analysis made it clear that the public realm cannot be given to the citizens, but it needs to be taken by the citizens themselves. Only then can it be public and free. We have seen tonight that enclaves have reduced the public spaces in Pacheville. We have seen that far from recreating a modern communal life, these enclaves destroy the little public space left. Sadly, this is a worldwide phenomenon. The increasing communalism and the politics of exclusion in the city are a characteristic of urban planning worldwide. I would like to add one last thing. Pacheville could very well be a testing ground for the model of future Maltese urbanity. This is not limited to coastal areas where modern life and tourism thrives, and speculation as well. It can very well spread to inland villages that are typically well preserved. Already in villages such as Balsan, a number of semi-gated communities have been built. The Orange Grove, for instance, seem to attract more and more people into their introverted utopic spaces. They may be at odds with the traditional buildings of the Maltese townscape, but that's not the important for me. The real threat comes not from the fact that we are not protecting our architectural heritage, but that we are not protecting democracy. We need to think of the morality of such spaces. So thank you very much.
Elise, thank you for a very provocative and wide-ranging paper. I'm sure you'll have questions on a range of issues, precisely because it was so wide-ranging. Mm. I'll just open up with a kind of question, a kind of critique. I really like the thrust of your paper, which is to say that these developments, these gated communities, these hotels, these big hotels, have severely reduced public space and are threatening remaining public space. I take that to be one of your main arguments, and I'm thank you very much for having outlined it so carefully to the point when one can see real cause for alarm. But you also have another argument, which I think is in tension with your main argument. The other argument concerned what Pacheville residents feel, think, compared with the nighttime users. Here, on a point of fact, I wonder really whether the majority of nighttime users, youth culture, are foreign. Certain times of summer, yes, but I think through the winter months, The great majority as...
Yes, I'm Maltese, yeah.
Mm-hmm. As Malta's most prominent Pacheville-going professor.
You had to say it, huh?
I had to say. I think it's primarily Maltese. Mm. Dubiously young people. Literally from 14 up to... I won't fill in the blank. But here, you seemed, to put it crudely, to, as it were, take the side of the residents.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I see this as a tension point in your paper, because if you want to say that Pacheville provides a possible testing ground for a future urbanity in Malta,
yeah,
which implies that you think it's lacking now, fair enough. But you can't say that and at the same time not acknowledge that what's happened is, quote unquote, over the last 30 years, an invasion of entertainment facilities enjoyed by the young, very diverse. If you know your mm-hmm. Pacheville main streets, mm-hmm. there's a huge diversity in entertainment being offered. Mm-hmm. There are different youth tastes being yes. catered for, which is fascinating. Mm. And what makes fascinating so liberating for the Pacheville user is that you can jump from one lifestyle to another mm-hmm. in the space of a Saturday evening. That's what makes it fun. Mm-hmm. I would say that the cause of urbanity requires us to come down on the side of the lively youth users. And here, it seems to me that those streets, those main streets and that central space you talk about mm-hmm. deserve more attention mm-hmm. than we heard in the paper. Because it is the sheer density mm-hmm. of people mixing, talking, drinking, arguing, mm-hmm. debating, sampling, that you find, which constitutes the excitement and the specificity mm-hmm. of youth culture in Pacheville. Here, I think you're taking a very village-type view of mm-hmm. this space when you say residents have certain moral rights to quiet in the public streets. I think we have to concede a place in Malta which yes. is very noisy, very eclectic.
Indeed. Yeah, yeah, I agree.
I'm sorry, I disagree with you entirely.
I mean, you are looking at this, first of all, this culture that you are speaking about. I was a Pacheville resident, so I can really talk about this, was imposed without the residents ever having been consulted once. And it started out not as a youth culture, but it started out with play with bars for adults where money was played illegally. And I think that we tend to forget. And suddenly there was a government decision, which was not overt but covert, to turn this into a big place of entertainment where a lot of illegal money was made underhandedly, again at the expense of the residents. And in no, I mean, it might be fun for, and it was for you, but it was totally artificially built. There was no gradual process. It was suddenly forced upon the residents, whom most of whom did not have the means to leave Pacheville because they did not own their houses and therefore financially could not permit themselves to leave their houses, but had to continue living there. Nothing was ever done to reconcile their style of life with this artificiality that was imposed on them. And actually, the fact of having different lifestyles is actually a jigsaw puzzle of different commercial interests which invaded that space at different times and therefore following different trends of entertainment, and which now cohabit one next to the other, with the residents having to try and find to come up for air, basically, in all this mess. I mean, my family is one of the residents who adored living in Pacheville and who had to leave when suddenly a governmental or whatever ministerial decision decided that all traffic leaving Parcheval had to leave in front of our house, and that basically from a quiet residence we became the noisiest part of Parcheval at the time, because every single car that entered Parcheval had to leave from in front of my house. So I know exactly what I'm talking about. And suddenly we were faced with this, having to cope with these realities, none of which were done at any sort of possibly integrational pace, but were suddenly imposed one after the other as commercial interests grew larger and larger. And because the residents did not have the same type of commercial of financial type of clout, because I'm sure nobody would have gone in front of Angelo Schwireb's house and done the same thing, all right? They did not have the type of financial clout, or George Fenech himself, to counter this kind of invasion of occupation of space. They just had to succumb to it. And in fact, many of the residents who still live there are still paying rents. They could not afford even today to buy their houses, and certainly they wouldn't buy them because they have become totally a total non-financial viability. And my family were very lucky because we cleared out just before it became impossible to sell our flat. But the people who didn't, who live in our apartments, could never sell their house even if they wanted to today. And that is a serious reality, that basically the people who have invested in Parcheval, even by buying houses, have been impoverished because the level of their houses, unless it gives out directly onto the street, has gone down in value so much, you know? And I think those are also considerations to be taken in. Let's not forget that Parcheval was a village, and that therefore it had a village life. We all lived this village life. We were part of it. We shared it. We remember spaces which we called the sunken garden. For example, was the place where we all went and had our first kiss, and perhaps our first grope sometimes. And we all had the beach. Was suddenly were deprived of large chunks of beach, which we cannot even enter any longer when the Hilton took over. Which initially the Hilton had a very small part of the beach, very tiny part, and the rest of the beach was left for everybody, residents and non-residents included. In fact, Saturdays and Sundays it was full of non-residents. But then suddenly the residents were pushed to the side. And the Hilton took over in its grand way. So I'm sorry, but I have a problem with you telling me about the diversity, because that diversity echoes total commercial interest and big, sometimes money laundered money.
Can I carry on from Vicky a second? I was born in Parcheval. Just a couple of minutes. My dad still lives there, and the first commercial interests were the services, because St. Andrews was up the road, and they used to create a few fights, but nothing too serious, because then the disciplinary boards from the services used to go down on them, and they would be cleared up in no time at all. But I think Elise was commendable in mentioning the fact that the residents are not actually against foreigners. They have lived with foreigners all their lives. The British, the tourists, the Western Hotel is quite old over there. There was the Villa Rosa Hotel before as well. You know, quite a few really old, amongst the first hotels, probably the first area for tourism in Malta. What the residents are really against is the breaking of the law, people peeing in their private property. Only last week, my dad's neighbor found somebody groping up to his first floor bedroom. He climbed up somehow. This guy heard noises outside, and he came face to face with an intruder. I mean, it's the illegality, the lack of discipline, the breaking of laws flagrantly. With the police then, a lot of them having conflict of interest, because many police are also employed as security in bars, whatever. And who are the police going to stick up for? their part-time employer who gives them a good source of income, rather than the residents over there who are gradually being pushed out, because very few young people today would like to move to Parchville. It is not a desirable area, the grid you mentioned, for young people to move to. Thank you.
As you can see, this is a hot topic, and I'm very aware of it. And I want it this way. And that's why there is debate. That's why I think it's a very important place. I'm very sorry if you got the impression that I was kind of being with the residents against the nightlife. This is not, for example, when I speak about invasion, I stressed in my paper that the residents have complained, have said that they feel invaded, which I understand. But me as an anthropologist, that's not what I'm saying. I'm also saying that the change of morality, the change of norms of behavior, has been liberating for many people who do need a place in Malta where to recreate. So no, what I'm saying is just that. My point of view is that it's nice that there are different people. What the problem is, maybe, and I'm not talking too much about it, but the thing would be that these different actors, the residents, the bar owners, the party goers, Maltese foreigner, whatever, if they could only speak and find a proper solution, which is lacking for some time, it seems. That's my main point.
Well, it's just that I didn't really know that there were residents in Patchville. For me, it was, I came here 5 years ago, and for me, Patchville was always a nightlife area. I knew that people were living there, but I didn't know that there were actually residents living there for a long time. I thought it was just an empty space that was used by the Maltese to fill it up with nightlife, night bars and stuff like that. For me, it's true that no one has... Yeah. People who haven't lived here for a long time don't really know that there was actually a life before Patchville. We only know Patchville as Patchville.
That's
the
life. There is still
identification
life.
Of... So it's interesting that she describes this and she makes us, realize that there is actually a life without... without all the tourists, without all the... that there is actually people living here. Mm. It's amazing.
Yeah, and also I think what is important, not only the residents, mind you, also the Maltese. As Vicky was saying, also many Maltese used to come for picnic or on their Sundays. What I think is important is that it seems to me that in the medias, in the newspapers and TV, we're only talking about the nightlife of Patchville. We're not talking about so much about the residents. We're not talking about the enclaves, about the segmentation of space. You see, we're looking at just one side of the problem. And in fact, for some people, it's not so much a problem, neither.
I mean, I got a sense from your paper of the sort of unstoppable nature of this. And in a way that almost it's happening without anyone really directing it. It's a sort of like a logic, I'm thinking in a sense of Foucault, sort of a carceral logic pervading and going through the architecture, being manifested in small things. Also a sense that as one zone gets gated or gets parchivalized, so... this is going to have an impact on another zone. So because the spaces actually are connected, in a sense, at least geographically, the cysts or the capsules are going to create other capsules. So the the segmentary logic, in a way, is going to percolate. Mm-hmm. And, really the question in my mind is whether anyone can stop it, actually. I suppose one thing that does make it possible is the fact that it happens, in a sense, we all seem to desire it and we don't really realize what's going on. So the very act of making it an object of discussion does sort of undermine the hegemony of it all. And I just wonder, the parallels between Israel-Palestine and what's happening in the occupied territories, the segmentation of the space, building of,
Yes, there's a whole literature about walls and borders and... which seems to be pervading everywhere. But as you said very well, I mean, the only thing I can do myself is making it visible, understandable.
I can see, I have to concede that clearly there has been a rise of extremely powerful commercial interest who dominate the entertainment industry there. One can see it at work. And yet it seems to me that Pacheville is sufficiently flexible, sufficiently diverse, sufficiently large, sufficiently open, that there remain a variety of entertainment outlets and things going on at night. I thoroughly accept the idea that, in fact, we should be worried about the lack of democratic decision-making in the determination of space, in the way hotels and these encapsulations are taking over increasing amounts of space. And as David just said, there sadly appears to be an unstoppable logic, which at the base is a call for more public debate and for, I suppose, a Pacheville council some autonomy and some power of its own, a local council of its own, which would force local decision making onto people. All of this I can accept. And as you say, fair enough, there are residents whose wishes are not being considered. Having said that, I'm afraid I see also a certain fait accompli. A huge change has occurred. Now Pacheville has become a site of entertainment. This does mean there are going to be certain streets which are empty, as you said, but certain streets which are very, very crowded. And people who are unfortunately renting or living there, I can see no solution. I think, in fact, the flow of people must be allowed to continue, or else Malta is deprived of any alternative space. At the moment, arguably, Sliema and Valletta are villages writ large. You may choose to disagree with my point of view. There is something radically different about public space in Pacheville, which I think ought to be retained, which is a good thing. That's my point.
They're trying to export the Pacheville model to Valletta with Straight Street. Maybe it's at an embryonic phase, but they're doing it maybe in a more sophisticated way, but they're trying to just have two main streets where people can have their nightlife, like they're doing in Pacheville, and then the rest of the city can have their its day life as usual, but that's what they're trying to do. So I don't know if this model can be exported, if we can accept this kind of model to be exported. That's the only thing that is objectable.
I'm not sure whether this is exactly what's happening, though, in Valletta, because I hope not. I see it happening in Imdina, for example, the Imdina ditch, the way that has been emptied of social life.
That's a nice enclave as well, yeah.
But in Valletta, the problem with Valletta, anyway, was that till recently it didn't seem to have any real nightlife. There was no sleazy side to it, and you can't really have a city which doesn't have a sleazy side to it. So, in a sense, I see the problem as being this. So, if Valletta has a bit of a nightclub and so on, you know, that would be good. I doubt that the way Valletta is structured, they can create this kind of zoning on it. So, hopefully not.
I think that what your paper underlines is the fact that the more the public space is encroached upon by these enclaves, the more it is condensed and therefore becomes more intense. Because had these spaces, which have now become all private spaces, allowed for an enlargement of the public space, perhaps there wouldn't be the same density and intensity, and therefore not the same, the same eruption and stress on people who, on the lives of people who live there. First of all, I think the fact that is bad urban planning to start with, and certainly that kind of urban planning, because from what you showed us, I think what was very interesting was that the fact of these enclaves are all rich enclaves. There is a social question there, which is very, very important, and which has actually considerably reduced the possibility of going around. Because, for example, before it was much easier to get from Pacheville to Alit. Mm-hmm. Very, very simple. You could get through by the beach. You could get through by the streets. You could get. Now it's a real problem. So that has created, less communication, etc. And secondly, with regard to the to the development of Valletta, people are talking of Straight Street because before Straight Street was the area which was actually the area of entertainment, dubious or non, but certainly an area of entertainment with bars. I mean, first jazz clubs were after all in Straight Street.
And a poor area as well.
But the big difference was that this was a poor area. And it wasn't, there was no sort of great capitalistic venture behind the exploitation of Straight Street, which is not the case in Parcheville, to start with. And secondly, the fact of artificially wanting to recreate, to redevelop Straight Street is also bringing in danger. Because in reality, we have there, in Valletta, we have a different situation of enclaves. We have the chic enclave, which are the buildings that are bought by the companies, and who want to create centers of prestige through their, through the way they decorate and through the inner courtyards, which you glimpse through glass glass doors.
And some are in Straight Street.
Exactly, and some are in Straight Street. And then you have the enclaves of the poor who are hidden from sight and who have theoretically, and who are called up whenever it suits politicians or entrepreneurs to call them up, but who have really been, and who basically even their means of entertainment are threatened. Because let us not forget that the fact of removing the creation of floats from Valletta itself has and is going to have an impact on the community apart from on the carnival, if we're thinking of carnival. Mm-hmm. Because the community worked much around the fact of the creation of floats and therefore the creation of costumes and therefore the creation of dances, etc. And it was the entertainment, the day-to-day entertainment of a whole community, which was then manifested during carnival. So there is this as well. There is an infringement on something in order to create order. And I think this fact of creating order and beautiful places and tidy places, etc., etc., I think one of the points that you said, which is a space is not given to, but appropriated by a community. And I think that our planners have forgotten this, or have chosen to forget it, because there are money interests which are very, very big,
Elise, what you're doing is you're opening up an argument about the use of public space, which is what has brought people together and what has preceded. That is to say, we are now arguing over how it can or should be used. I can think of all kinds of other questions to ask you, particularly when we're looking at what kinds of comparison which can be made between urbanity, however defined in Malta, and the sorts of huge metropolitan urbanities characteristic of Chicago, New York, Paris, God knows where. I mean, issues of scale come in which may not even be achievable in Malta, you see. But this whole idea of an overflow, of an excess of energy, of an abundance of transgression, I think should be allowed. And at the moment, Malta is always debating whether they should be allowed at all. That's what. But thank you very much for opening up so much.
Yeah. Just one last thing, just to say. It's not me who opened the debate. The debate is there at Empatcheville. It's just people are not looking at it. And again, I think this is where there is a solution, you see. The solution is in the debate around the issue of Parcheville, and not only looking only at the crime zone and the nightlife. The nightlife is good, but it's a part of it. Let's not forget the other interests. It's a complex picture also, because some residents were also and are also benefiting from, very few, but they are benefiting from the industry, for the nightlife industry. So, yeah.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Elise.
You have just listened to a talk in the Work in Progress seminar series entitled When the Dark Night Rises, The Morality of Public Space. The talk was delivered by Elise Billiard.